watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this
week you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Venner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren.
This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. A listener to this show wrote on his blog that he's been finding the programs on the gift economy interesting, though, he said, he's skeptical that we could have a society without money or exchange. I'm not surprised that he's skeptical. Most people would be. This, in itself, is interesting, given that the system of money and markets is purely a human invention that came into being at a point in human history. And there was a long time, most of human history, where it had not been invented. Almost everything about human societies is an invention. Yet we treat these arbitrary, often absurd, often cruel social arrangements and laws as if they were laws of nature, something inescapable like gravity, when they could all be changed, swept away by an act of collective will, and replaced with something more to our liking. Why don't we believe that the possible is possible? We'll begin the program with a talk by Dr. Michael Parenti that will take this question on. We'll finish the show with a resumption of readings from Forgiving, A Feminist Critique of Exchange by Genevieve Vaughn. The talk by Michael Parenti you're about to hear was given last spring at the University of Washington and comes to us thanks to Mike McCormick of Mind Over Matters Radio. For new listeners who haven't heard the many Parenti talks played on the show over the years, Dr. Michael Parenti is a political scientist and radical social critic who has written nearly a score of books, among them titles such as Democracy for the Few, The Culture Struggle, Inventing Reality, and Super Patriotism. Here's Michael Parenti with an antidote for The Matrix.
Thank you. When they always ask me, do you need a screen, do you need this, I say, I need only two things, a water and a sound system that works. And I usually get the water. It's true. I don't quite understand why that's the case. Why is there such sound system problems all over America in universities? You don't know what it is? And why that's so funny for some of you. Stop it. Well, I want to begin with some questions. How do we perceive social reality? I thought I'd start with some small questions here. Okay. How do we perceive social reality? What is objectivity? In this age of empire, how do we arrive at the truth and still retain our sanity? These are some of the questions that inform this present inquiry. The usual criticism made about objectivity is that it doesn't exist. We're not just passive receptors sponging up images and information. Perception, as you know, involves selecting and omitting, organizing data into comprehensive forms. In other words, the act of perceiving something is itself an act of editing, which introduces certain kinds of distortions. There's that classical Walter Lippmann statement that he made, 80 years ago, we don't see things and then define them. We define them first and then see them. But the mental selectors we use to organize our perceptions are not mostly of our own creation. Much of our personal perception is really not all that personal. Rather, it's shaped by a variety of things outside of ourselves, such as the dominant ideology, conventional social values, one's position in the social structure, the available flow of information and disinformation, the potential benefits and losses that are attached to such perceptions. There's Upton Sinclair's famous quotation where he said, "It's very difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." So, Alvin Gulner, he argued that our readiness to accept or decline or reject some view rests less on the evidence and the argument that's presented for that particular view and more on how it fits our background assumptions, that is the climate of opinion. Climate of opinion was a term that Carl Becker, I think, first used, but that's very much the same. The notions that don't fit our background assumptions are seen as too far out and lacking in credibility. It's a very small lectern we've got here. Okay. No, I just like a good sound system if I could get it. Okay. Today, an analogous concept might be the dominant paradigm. A paradigm is a philosophical or theoretical framework within which empirical hypotheses are drawn and scientific theories developed. That's what we usually mean by paradigm. It's developed a more popular use. It means the dominant paradigm means the mainstream ideology. And you see bumper stickers that say subvert the dominant paradigm. And the dominant paradigm is based on the unanimity of bias. And that unanimity of bias is what passes for objectivity in mainstream discourse. Well, if objectivity is really little more than conformity of bias, then isn't one paradigm about as reliable or unreliable as another? Is all truth then nothing more than is nothing more than opinion or belief? If not, what makes a dissident, heterodox analysis better than an orthodox or mainstream one? Or do we lapse into a relativism, which is, you know, who's to say? You got your opinion, I got my opinion, that's that. And the fundamentalists do argue this. I heard Pope Benedict say it, and I've heard some of the televangelists say it, too. They posit their fundamental absolutist beliefs as being fixed and true and reliable. And if you don't have their fundamental absolutist beliefs, then the only alternative to that is a relativism, which is that anything goes and who's to say and what's true, what's not true, it doesn't matter. And what's right, what's wrong, who knows, there isn't anything like that. Well, I would argue that, in fact, that's not where we're left, that you can say that the dissenting opinion, the radical view, the views that are outside the mainstream, the views that are outside this unanimity of bias are generally, not always, but generally, are more reliable than the dominant view because they're more regularly challenged and tested against evidence. They don't get a free float down the mainstream. They're not supported by the unanimity of bias that passes for objectivity. Regarding orthodoxy, the most insidious oppressions are those that so insinuate themselves into the fabric of our lives and into the recesses of our minds that we don't even realize they're acting upon us. In the face of this, the heterodox view, the dissenting view, is not just another opinion among many. It has a special task to contest the prevailing orthodoxy, to broaden the boundaries of debate, to wake people up, to unearth suppressed data. The function of orthodox opinion is just the opposite, to keep the parameters of discourse as narrow as possible. Just listen to a presidential press conference, for instance. To dismiss evidence that ill fits the dominant paradigm. So all opinions are not of the same value. It depends on what they're being used for, what interests they serve. We've all observed that if something doesn't fit what people believe, now you know what that, you know about this. If something doesn't fit what people believe, they marshal up their reserved defenses and arguments, and sometimes very bitterly and very unyieldingly and unreceptively. It's called visiting relatives, right? Okay, how many have had this experience? You bring somebody up. No, not that experience. A new one. I mean, right? Hands eagerly shoot up into the air. I want to describe for you an example like this. You meet someone who has a firm belief about something, and you give that person contradictory data. You say, but this, and they say, oh, well, in that case, given that contradictory evidence and that, I now surrender my beliefs and I embrace yours. Now raise your hand if that's happened to you. Okay, your laughter is the answer to my question. I taught years ago, I guess it was about in the 80s, I taught at Cornell University for a year as a visiting professor, and I was teaching a communications class of upperclassmen, juniors and seniors, and they, and somewhere about a third through the course, a couple of them complained and said, we're getting only one viewpoint in this class. And I said, well, no, we've got on the syllabus, we've got this reading and this reading, and I don't agree with this reading, and we discuss other questions. I said, but you know, you're right. That really, the perspective in this course, the communication students, and it was a course on the media, the perspective is very critical of the existing media that you have here, and it's a very definite critique. You're right. You're getting that point of view. It's true. It was a class of about 50 students. So I said, how many of you have had other social science courses, such as sociology, political science, economics, social psychology, anthropology, history, whatever, communications courses? And every hand went up. Everybody had at least three or four or more social science courses. I said, and how many of you in all those other courses got this point of view? Not a single hand went up. A measure of the ideological pluralism and diversity of Cornell University. And then I said, and how many of you in those other courses complained that you were getting only one point of view? In all those other courses that you took. Again, not a hand went up. I said, so you're not complaining that you're getting only one point of view. You're complaining that for the first time you're getting a second point of view, and you can't tolerate it. Now, if people cannot challenge the validity of the evidence you present, they have fallback positions. I remember the Moscow intellectuals back when there was a Soviet Union, back in the 1980s. There was a very interesting article written, of all places, in the National Review, a conservative right-wing magazine, where the author described the Moscow intellectuals as loving Ronald Reagan, Marlboro cigarettes, and the Confederacy during the Civil War. And that, I thought, was a very accurate description, given the ones I met when I was there. They hated socialism. And a friend of mine, she had the same experience. She was in Leningrad with the Soviet intellectuals there. And one guy said to her, he said, "The poorest people in your country live better than I do." And here's a guy who had gone to Moscow University. He spoke fluent English. He had a small but comfortable apartment. He had a wall full with books. He never missed a meal in his life, but he was convinced that the poorest in your country, in America. And when I used to hear him talk, their eyes would begin to sparkle. America. And she said, "Well, that's not true. We have people in our country who sleep in doorways and pick through garbage cans and such." And you know what they said to her? They said, "That's all right. You don't have to lie to us anymore." And she said, "No, really." And she cited some statistics and was talking about this. She said, "What's the fallback, the first fallback position? Where did you get those figures from?" She said, "From the federal government, Bureau of Labor Statistics, U.S. Census Bureau. It's public knowledge." So their second fallback position is, say, "Oh, those are just the blacks. The blacks, they're lazy and stupid, and so, yeah, they're poor, yeah." That's a rhetorical fallback position. I've given that a technical term, descriptive term. And I forgot what I did. Oh, yes, racism. I call that racism. So it so happened that she had a copy of Mother Jones with her, and there was a special photo feature in that issue of the poor of Appalachia. 30 years after Kennedy's war on poverty in Appalachia, these people were as poor as ever, and there were pictures of their destitution. And so she brought this out. She said, "Look, Appalachia, they're all white, you know, 99% sort of like Seattle, but and she said, "Look at this." And they looked at the pictures, and they had another fallback position, which was what? "Oh, so there were a few white people who were poor out in the country, and so that's so unusual they made a whole article with photographs about them." You see, so beliefs are not surrendered. Beliefs are rather frighteningly impervious to evidence sometimes. The Soviet intellectuals believed America was a capitalist paradise. They knew, by the way, when I spoke to the ones I spoke to in Moscow, they knew so much more about America than I did. I was handicapped by experience and reality, which, as you know, is a messy kind of multidimensional thing. They had all the certainty of inexperience. The believers in the capitalist paradise were a mirror image of the believers of this, that those who believed that the Soviet Union was a workers' paradise. And there were many people who I knew, people in the party and fellow travelers and such, who had heard so much negative. I mean, everything about these communist countries was bad. There wasn't ever a single positive thing ever said. So their reaction was to reject every single criticism. The girlfriend I had right back then, too, in the 80s, she was a party member. And I remember I would raise questions, you see, not from a position of hostility, but from a position of I'd like this system to work a lot better and be more viable. And said, "Look, there are real problems here." And we would end up in really banging heads together. It was just impossible to have a rational discussion and introduce things. I can think of another lady I know who... Now, that was in New York. Well, my girl, well, I lived in, it doesn't matter. This was another friend of mine, red diaper, a third-generation Communist Party, and she says to me, now this was a woman in her late 40s, an experienced woman, and she says, there's no prostitution in the Soviet Union. I said, Esther, what are you talking about? So this is a country of 340 million people, wars, scarcities, all the imperfections of human beings and self-serving exploitations and motives. Are you telling me in this whole country there's no prostitution? She says, there's no prostitution. A year later, I headed a delegation to the Soviet Union made up of economists and political scientists. And I remember our guide in Moscow, she said, again, she was a woman about late 40s, early 50s. She said, there is no prostitution in my country. You see, now we're trying to explore the nature of belief here. How do people have belief? And I said to her, I said, you know, there may not be any prostitution in your country, but there sure is a hell of a lot of it in our hotel right here downstairs. And you know what she said without missing a beat? Yes, well, I want you to know all those girls have full-time jobs during the day. Talk about fallback position. So people, you're not, if you're engaged in political discourse and political struggle, as I am all the time, in political communication, you realize that you're not doing politics. You're doing religion. It's religion you're dealing with because you're dealing with belief. And it's a rough deal. I mean, it's with good reason that we use words like political dogma and sectarian. These are religious terms, you know. Talking about the Soviet Union, let me talk about it, and I'm doing it deliberately because it's such a taboo subject. I can just think of very, very eminent progressive speakers who cannot get 2 feet into U.S. foreign policy back in the 80s and 90s, and even till today they still do it without mentioning the monstrous Soviet Union, the horrible Soviet Union. The two most eminent do it all the time. I won't even give any names. But I want to say I thought of the Soviet Union rather differently. I thought it had certain features, and this was why I think I got attacked as Stalinist, Soviet apologist, and all that. I thought the Soviet Union had certain features that were worth emulating. And even after its overthrow, I thought it had certain features that were worth keeping, such as universal health care, free education, affordable housing, and all other such components of what people on the left call the social wage. It's a Marxist term. Well, all of that's gone now. That's been destroyed at great suffering for the population, especially among pensioners and older and more vulnerable people and among younger people and among women, professional women who have to turn to prostitution, the fastest growing profession in the former Soviet Union. All the public capital has been stolen by private swindlers and speculators. Stephen Cohn, very good Sovietologist, wrote that very fine biography on Bukharin, one of the old Bolsheviks who was purged, you know. He says today, he said, that country, Russia today, is living off the corpse of the Soviet capital, of what was once there, and it's doomed. Well, I advocated at that time, and I still do now to historians, that what we should do is look at the Soviet Union, to use another social science term, with what is the term? Object differential appraisal. That you look at it and you think, I'm sorry, differential object appraisal. You make a differential object appraisal. You see it not as one monolithic thing, not as a worker's paradise, not as a monstrous hell, but you look at it in many different facets and sides, its crimes, its successes, its failures. You know, one thing you say about communist Russia and communist China is they took hundreds of millions of people moved from feudal serfdom to a modern society where they had enough to eat and went to school and had literacy. An incredible, hundreds of millions of people, an accomplishment never emulated before or since in human history. And so can we look at that without sharpening our knives and always having to make your genuflection to the anti-communism? It was and still is forbidden to say anything positive about that system. But apparently, many people in Russia today agree with me. Look at the study done in 2005, just a few years ago, by Richard Pipes, a leading Harvard Sovietologist. I used to call him a leading Harvard anti-Sovietologist. He was one of those guys who led the charge in the Cold War against the imaginary hordes of Marxists who were all over the place. As you know, we're taking over America and American academia, and all. I don't know what part of Harvard he was teaching in. Well, Pipes did this study in 2005. It was a very exhaustive and extensive opinion research study in Russia, a survey, and he found painfully, uncomfortably, unhappily. He found, I will give him credit, he published, he went public with it. If this study had been done by the White House, it would have been suppressed. We would never have heard of it. He found that in Russia, the great majority are no longer in love with the capitalist paradise. Now that they're living in it, you know, they had a different feeling. Here's the datum that's most salient. 74% regret the demise of the Soviet Union and believe that life was better under communism. Similar results, by the way, similar studies have been done with similar results in other communist countries. I can think offhand of Bulgaria and Poland. Such things are reported in the Western press, have been for the last decade or more, but with no explanation and with relatively little comment. Except in the early years, that was their fallback position, which is, well, these people are all so unhappy because they are used to being taken from cradle to grave and being told what to do and feel. And now they're cut adrift and they don't know how to exercise self-reliance and self-initiative. And so they're unhappy with this system. See, it's just a feeling. That's the fallback position. And it is true, you know, when you get thrown out of your job and your pension disappears and you're kicked out of your rent control apartment, it does do something to your sense of self-reliance. It does. When the orthodox view becomes so entrenched, evidence becomes irrelevant. The demonization of the Serbian people and their democratically elected president, Slobodan Milosevic. I'm giving you the hard cases today, right? No one has ever accused me of shirking or trimming. Some have wished that I would. Some have sidled up to me and advised me to do that. They would tell me that you will reach more people if you say less. You'll have a greater impact if you dilute your punch. Well, the demonization of the Serbs was one of the great propaganda achievements that took in many liberals and progressives also. I wrote a book about that called To Kill a Nation, The Attack on Yugoslavia. Carla Del Ponte, the hanging judge at that kangaroo court put up in the Prague by the NATO powers. They set it up in the Prague to make it look like it's part of the World Court or something. It was the independent tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. She admitted last year that the prosecution in this case had no evidence to support the charge of genocide against Milosevic and the Serbs. And Milosevic was launching his defense A very effective one. His cross-examination, he was demolishing. There were people getting up on the stand who were admitting that this is all fabricated, that they weren't there, that they didn't know, that they never saw the atrocity, that they were told they had to do this or they would get deported or blah, blah, blah. Things like that were happening. It was amazing. That's why you never heard any of it in the media. And then Milosevic's defense disappeared because he died suddenly. Serbia, in fact, I want to give you just one datum. Serbia is the only republic, not Slovenia, not Montenegro, not Croatia, not Bosnia. Serbia is the only republic that still is multi-ethnic. You have Albanians and Croatians and Bosnians living in Serbia. I can tell you, that's one of the great facts. That's one of the datum that's been dropped down the memory hole. Serbia is the only republic that has not done ethnic cleansing, and yet it's the one that has been charged with ethnic cleansing. And you can get that evidence right from UN reports and right from the mainstream media, actually. Radical publications like the Wall Street Journal, which every so often carries a good story, which you should appreciate, because once Rupert Murdoch buys it, you can use it to line your garbage can after that. Now, I give you some other hard ones like that. The stolen election of 2004. I think I put that article, I know I put it, on my website, michaelparenti.org. Go take a look at that. People allowed that there was some finagling in Florida in 2000. But in 2004, the media came rushing in to legitimate the election. We couldn't go another 2-3 weeks, a spectacle to the world. No, no. No, Bush had won it, despite the enormous theft, great evidence of theft of all kinds in Ohio, Florida, New Mexico, Nevada. My article summarizes remarkable work done by Congressman John Conyers, or writers like Bob Fetrakis, Harvey Wasserman, Steve Freeman, and there was one or two other. Mark Crispin Miller, thank you, because I relied on him a lot, and I couldn't remember the name. Yeah. Here's another one, the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan. It wasn't an invasion. The left military government three times asked the Soviets in, and they were very reluctant to go in, and then they finally did. And what was that government doing? That government was doing very terrible things like having women go to school, land reform, breaking the feudal tribes, trying to allow for room for a secular society. The Shangri-La image of Tibet before the Chinese crackdown. Try to discuss that. I live in a Tibet country. I've been living in it about 15 years. It's called Berkeley, California. And you see what happens there and the stuff that I got hit with on that one. And by the way, every one of these I have written about and taken a stand on. The findings of the Warren Commission about the JFK assassination. The research on that is just marvelous. From the forensic, the medical, the cover-up research is just incredible, the wealth of research. But try to get a rational discourse in the mainstream on that one. The findings or non-findings of the 9/11 Commission. There are many unanswered questions about 9/11 that really do need further investigation. I mean, would you really accept a commission that's been handpicked by George Bush? Think of it that way. Doing a class power analysis of the American political system, or talking about class power in any context. Such issues as these, and there must be others, I don't say that's an exhaustive list, cross the boundary of allowable opinion. They move into forbidden terrain, and you are just very often denied the opportunity for rational discourse. Through a process of immediate assertion and intensive repetition. Repetition, it just comes. The genocide thing on the Serbs, I remember, there was no evidence. The first day it appeared in the Times, there was with quotes. that this genocide, and then the next day quotes, and then the quotes were dropped, and then the word, as it is used, it becomes easier and easier to use. The intensive repetition, through this method, the universe of discourse is preempted and it's monopolized. As to what then is truth, we perhaps can back into that question the way we can answer it by backing into it by saying that we know truth exists because we know liars exist. We may not always know when our leaders are lying to us, but after a while we catch on. You know the saying, you can't fool all the people all the time, but if you do it once, it's good for 4 years, right? And what a 4 years it was, and then another 4 years, we're in it still. What's often missing from public discourse and mainstream political study is the political economic content of something, of the issue. The media are amazing. They can tell you about this, and there were people there, and others were behind that, but they don't tell you what's the issue, what is the conflict about, what's the substance of it, why are all these things going on, what's the goal. You can read American government textbooks of the standard mainstream variety, and you'll read that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is a voice of the business community. These textbooks will often have a section called public interest groups, and you'll have the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and just as the AFL-CIO is for labor. It's always balanced in these books. They're always balanced. What you usually don't get is the politico-economic content of this politico-economic organization known as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. You don't hear, you don't read, that for almost a century, the chamber opposed laws that legalized labor unions. It opposed collective bargaining. It was against the abolition of child labor. It was against fair labor practices. It was against minimum wage increases. It was against legal protections for workers as under the NLRB. It was against regulations to protect the economy. You don't hear that. How can they talk about the Chamber of Commerce without ever really saying what it does? I'm reminded of something C. Wright Mills said years ago, that in the face of such informational vapidity, is there such a word as vapidity? Vapor? Vapidity? Did I just make that up? What?
It's a word now.
There is now. I did. In the assassination of Julius Caesar, I did invent a word. It was about all the Roman aristocracy always has three names: Gaius, Julius Caesar, you know, Tullius, what his name is, Tiberius, Cicero, whatever. And I call them trinomina. These trinomina, beautiful word. I've used it again in a later thing too. It'll catch on. You'll see. Say, oh. Okay, what was I saying? Vapidity. C. Wright Mills saying, in the face of such informational vapidity and cover-up, simple facts can have the import of radical acts. And we see that with this administration. We're just bringing forth certain simple facts about certain things. This is treated like an act of radical rebellion, which in effect it is, in its impact it is. Now, this slighting of content, this avoiding political economic content, is a common means of maintaining the dominant paradigm. Never go too far into social reality. Never cross any lines beyond permissible opinion. I remember one time in the American Political Science Association, we were having this big debate of the decade or something. It was Philip Green and I against Nelson, Philip Green of Smith College, me, and we were debating Nelson Polsby and Aaron Woldofsky of University of California Political Science, Berkeley. And I remember at one point turning to Wildowski and saying, how can you teach and write about the American presidency for 35 years without ever once mentioning capitalism? Well, the look on his face, he startled like I was Donald Duck or something. He just was looking, and it occurred to me that this was the first time in those 35 years he had ever been asked that question. So the absence of political economic content is a chronic thing. It's evident in the discussion about empire also. When I was writing that book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, I have a section on empire in that, but the book is not mostly about imperialism or empire or conquest. It's about the internal politics of the Roman Republic. But when I was writing that book, I was reading a lot about empire, and I discovered something very, very interesting, that most of the literature on empire is kind of favorable toward empire. It's kind of admiring of empire, that, you know, empires are seen as grand accomplishments, as bringing stability where there had been chaos, bringing peace and dominion among these squabbling tribes, you know. You see that in those movies, too, you know. The greatness of Rome. You must remember Rome. And we were like, we're all supposed to be sitting there going, Rome, whoa, whoa. And those are my ancestors, you know. We even give empires peace names. Pax Romana, Pax Britannica. Empires, but I'll tell you one thing. I'll tell you that later. Empires, empires are also often seen as innocent, unintentional accretions. They arise stochastically. Stochasticism, write it down. Stochasticism is the theory that things happen by chance or random, that you can't see consistent patterns in this way. You know, just stuff happens. That's the way it is. I remember in my salad days hearing that the British Empire was put together in a fit of absent-mindedness. That used to be a phrase. Used to hear that. I heard teachers say that to me. British historian Cyril Robinson, I quote him in the Caesar book, he says the same thing about the Roman Empire. Quote, it was perhaps almost as true of Rome as of Great Britain that she acquired her world domination in a fit of absence of mind. Yeah, right. More recently, or Robinson was writing back in the 1940s, I think. More recently, how about 2003, The Economist, an eminent conservative British publication, very eminent, as you know, wrote the following in an unsigned editorial in August 2003, about 4 months after the invasion of Iraq by U.S. forces, and this unsigned article was addressing that invasion. And it began like this. Empires are born in funny ways, and sometimes via the law of unintended consequences by accident. Empires are born by accident. There it is, accident. Well, I'm sorry. Empires are not innocent, absent-minded, accidental, unintentional accretions. They are given force by purpose-driven rulers who consciously have to mobilize vast amounts of men and materials to conquer and plunder far-off places. I mean, the British just didn't just happen to find themselves in India, you know. Oh, look, fancy this. We thought we were going to go vacation in Greece, and we took a turn, and well, we're here now. We might as well plunder the place and rip it all to pieces and get rich off it. How's the accent? Pretty good, yeah. Lorraine? But the term empire was never applied to the United States. When I was a kid in class, there was a map, I remember, of the United States, and then there were these inserts on the sides. Puerto Rico, Alaska, Hawaii weren't yet states. Don't do the numbers. Forget about it. I was a very old kid. I was a very, very young, brilliant, young, 2 years old at the time. The Philippines, yes, the Philippines was. And I remember we said to the teacher, "Are those our colonies?" And the teacher, Miss Myers, she said, "America does not have colonies. Those are our territories." What's in a word, hey? The power of labeling. So you didn't say, you didn't talk about, when I wrote my book, Against Empire, in 1995, there were a few people who commented, "Empire? Come on, Parenti, aren't you going over the top here?" Talking about critique of U.S. interventionism, it's one thing. That's a bit much. The U.S. doesn't pursue empires. It propagates democracy, as we all know. But, you know, by 2000, 2001, suddenly all these books started coming out with the title of Empire in them. The Twilight of Empire, The Sorrows of Empire, The Follies of Empire, Empire at the Crossroads, Empire Gonna Get Your Mama, you know, I mean, every kind of... Even conservatives started using the word. The conservative pundits who overpopulate the Sunday talk shows and all these panel shows, you know, opinion panel shows, they were all starting to say things like, "We're an empire, and we got to accept the fact we're an empire, and we've got to start acting like an empire. It's time we started acting, and we've got to take on the responsibilities." It's as if, since we have this power, we have the entitlement. That power gives you some kind of moral entitlement to go out there and whack other countries if you want. Well, I started asking myself, how is it that so many people now suddenly feel free to talk about empire when they mean U.S. empire, not the wicked Soviet empire or the British empire or the Mongol or Persian empires? No, U.S. empire. How is it they're saying this? What am I missing? And I realized it wasn't something that I was missing. It's something that they were missing. That is, I realized that the word had been divested of its full meaning. Empire seems to mean, when most of these people write about it, it means simply dominion and power. What is missing from the public discourse is the process of empire, and even more important, the political economic content. For while we say a lot about this word, everybody's using this word now, empire, there's another word that's missing. There's another word that's missing that's very closely related to empire, and nobody ever uses it except a few of us. And that other word is imperialism. Now, isn't that fascinating? How can you talk about empire without ever mentioning imperialism? Because imperialism is the process of empire. Empires do imperialism. That's what they do. They do imperialism. It's like going to a medical conference of pulmonary specialists and they're all talking about our lungs and never once mentioning breathing, you know? So you got to say, what is missing from this picture? Well, imperialism is not only the process, it's the political economic content. Imperialism is when the ruling interests of one country expropriate the land, the labor, the natural resources, and the capital and the markets of another country. Imperialism means plunder and tribute. Empires are not just all about power. It's not power for power's sake. Nobody goes out and just goes and does power. Oh, let's go to Africa and conquer chunks of Africa because then we'll feel more powerful, you know. You go to Africa because there's something there that you want. It's one of the richest places in the world. That's where you got, tin, copper, diamonds, gold, hemp, timber, human beings, slaves, all the stuff that enriches you. That's what King Leopold, he didn't have any grudge about the people in the Congo. He didn't care one way or another about who they were, where they were, whether they lived or died. He just wanted them and work them in those mines so that he could get richer and richer and richer. So it's not power for power's sake. It's power to get your wealth and using your wealth to increase your power and using your power to maximize and secure your wealth. That's what it's about. That's what the guys who are in the White House today are doing. So it's plunder, it's tribute, it's these rich resources, it's expropriating the land, the crops, the cheap labor. Empires are enormously profitable, mostly for the ruling and investing class of the imperial country. Empires are enormously costly for the common populace, both of the targeted country and of the imperial country itself. The empire feeds off the republic's resources. Where the hell do you think this empire comes from? It comes from the republic. Where do they get these? Where do they get the money for these 380 military bases and these bombings and killings and shootings and destruction? They get it from our tax dollars. The people pay the taxes and do without essentials so that the patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. The center is bled so that the perimeter can expand and expand and expand. And you see that happening. We live in a country that has a runaway defense budget just this past year, $487 billion. That's just the basic Pentagon defense budget. It doesn't count another $124 billion for Iraq, another $30 or $40 billion for Afghanistan. And at home, what do we have? We've got public hospitals closing. We've got libraries cutting back their hours. We got sound systems that don't even work. Now you know why I'm angry. We got conservation programs being cut. We got Medicare under siege because we can't afford it. And we can't afford it. Where are we going to get all that money from? I got to work on my George Bush imitation, I know. We got education funding being cut back. What they do in the world, U.S. rulers, they do on purpose. They know what they're doing. Just because they mislead you and confuse you or us doesn't mean that they are necessarily confused. They may say all sorts of misleading things. A political writer, Lawrence McGuire, he sent me his article. I wrote a piece. Maybe I should tell you about this. Am I going too long? You want me to stop now? Other people have spoken. All right. I wrote an article. And you can, it's not on my website, but Common Dreams has it posted. It's called Mystery, How Wealth Creates Poverty in the World. And I pointed out that as U.S. investment has increased over the last half century dramatically in the third world, and IMF and World Bank loans have increased in the third world, and U.S. aid to the third world has increased. While all of this has gone on for half a century, during that half a century, poverty has increased. Today, the number of people living in poverty is growing at a faster rate than the world's population. So as wealth accumulates, poverty spreads because there's a dynamic interrelation between the two. And I said, so here's the mystery. Why is that a mystery? It's such a conundrum. How do we figure this out? Well, there's no mystery, really. Unless you assume that these investors and these aid people and these bankers manipulating this debt are doing all this to help the people in these countries, if you drop that assumption and you say they're doing it to help themselves, then it's a perfectly rational system. They're making tremendous amounts of money. These investments aren't designed to uplift the people, to build up their domestic industries, to give them a viable economy, to make their food supply secure and those things. These investments are there to get them off the land, to take the wealth out of them, to reduce the price of their labor down to shantytown starvation levels. And so is the aid. All these countries have to buy it from U.S. And so with the debt, the loans. The loans are sent in, and then they're trapped in the loan, and then they're hit with more money sent to them, and they're forced to do SAPs, it's called SAPs, structural adjustment programs, which means cut back on all your own domestic subsidies and development and all that. So these programs are designed to impoverish these people, and they've been very successful. And the liberal critic comes along and says, this isn't working, because he's smarter. He's so much smarter than all these people who've been doing this all this while. No, he isn't. He's the dumbest one in the room. He always thinks that American foreign policy is so stupid and so confused, and our dealings with these countries are off on a wrong leg and all that. Why? Well, Larry McGuire writes to me. He says, I loved your article, and it answered the question that I posed in mine. And I wish I could just read his piece, because I liked his piece. I wrote him back. But he was trying to understand international finance and what happened in Argentina. And he read three liberal writers. He read Mark Cooper of The Nation, Mark Cooper, who never met a U.S. war he didn't love and support. And he supported the destruction of Yugoslavia, a viable social democracy. He supported the Gulf War. He supports this war in Iraq right now. Mark Weisbrot and Paul Krugman of the New York Times. All three of them writing about Argentina. And McGuire, with feigned innocence, he notes that all three said that Argentina had been a gold mine for international investors and big speculators, a source of huge profits. You remember when Argentina crashed, when the whole economy went into a burnout. It just went down some years ago. This is what we're talking about. The IMF forced Argentina to slash its protective tariffs, privatize its state enterprises, and transfer huge sums from Argentine taxpayers to the pockets of the big money people and the IMF. McGuire, he notes that Cooper, Weisbrot, and Krugman condemn the crisis in Argentina, that these three say that the IMF, and these are various quotes, created a failed model, the program was an error, a catastrophic failure, a failed experiment, a disaster. But McGuire says, how so? Agreed, it was a disaster for the Argentinians and for Argentina. But the free market IMF policies made Wall Street cheer, as Krugman himself said, and it reaped billions for investors. In other words, the policy worked very well for a small group of very wealthy people. Isn't that what the policy was supposed to do? McGuire asks. The IMF has pursued these same policies in many other countries. If an institution does the same thing over and over again with profitable results, why is it a failure? Because it brought hardship to the people of these countries? What's that got to do with getting rich? As McGuire says, I quote him, I would call it a well-crafted policy that must work for the people implementing that policy. Otherwise, why would they continue doing it? What's experimental about it? It's been doing it for 40 years. What do you mean? Krugman called it an experimental policy that's gone wrong. We've got to stop it. So why do Cooper, Weisbrot, and Krugman call it a failure? I'm going to tell you why right now. This is why you paid your $10. Now's the moment. You're going to hear the real lowdown. What was the question again? Why do they call it a failure? They call it a failure because they want to stay within the dominant paradigm. They prefer to make a liberal complaint rather than a radical analysis. They assume a community of interest between the plutocratic investors and the working people of the recipient countries, when in fact there is no community of interest between those two. These three have no class analysis of the IMF. They assume that the rich plunderers who make billions off the IMF are primarily interested in helping others rather than in keeping themselves, rather than in helping themselves. They avoid all mention of that old Roman question, cui bono, that's Latin. It means what? Who benefits? That's right. Who's getting it? Who's benefit? This is being done because somebody is benefiting it in most cases. Now, the same for the war in Iraq.